Greetings and salutations, listeners. This is the podcast where Patrick Jackson and I drink whiskey and talk about scholarship on international theory. That's right, it's another exciting episode of Whiskey and International Relations Theory. This is the second of a two-part discussion of a pair of important articles by Alexander Wendt, The Agent Structure Problem in International Relations Theory, which was published in 1987, and Anarchy is What States Make of It, The Social Construction of Power Politics, which was published in 1992. This time we focus on the 1992 article and wrap things up. As always, our music is performed by Lyra Gemmell-Nexon. Now, I suppose we're at the part in the podcast life cycle where I start saying things like, if you enjoy Whiskey and I, Our Theory, consider leaving it a positive rating and review at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Google Play, or wherever you stream it from. But, you know, apparently that's like a good thing to do, so, you know, if you feel so inclined, please do. You can also email us directly at whiskeyindigoromeo@gmail.com. Those are the whole spell words, not W-I-R, but Whiskey Indigo Romeo. So without further ado, we rejoin the discussion. So what was your reaction to going back to Anarchy, What Is What States Make of It, after so many years?
What's fascinating, or what I found the most fascinating about the switch into the 92 piece, is that a lot of the thick co-constitution, regardless of the different ambiguities with this, which we've been sketching for most of this episode, that were existing in the 87 piece, that a lot of those are resolved or drop out and are seem to be resolved temporally and temporal sequentially in the 92 piece. So you end up with formulations like the formulation on page 395, structure has no existence or causal powers apart from process, which is not a word that figured very heavily in the 87 piece, the word process. Self-help and power politics are institutions, not essential features of anarchy. Anarchy is what states make of it. So we've gone from thick co-determination, in which agents and structures are ontologically linked to each other, to a view of structure which is dependent on practices of agents in order to give it meaning and reproduce it. So the foregrounding of the individual, which arguably we had a little bit in, is one of the threads in the 87 piece, but is kind of nuanced by all of the discussion of deep structural Marxist grammars and such, that has dropped out by 92. And in the 92 piece, we have states. Literally, he says at one point, states existing in a state of nature toward one another. So he picks up the language of liberal state of nature theory, and you have individuals that, in this case, quite literally pre-exist their interactions with each other. Exactly. Structure in the deep generative sense has been replaced in the 92 piece by a symbolic interactionist account of what you might call reciprocal typification, and what Wendt calls, drawing on Berger and Luckman, reciprocal typification. I treat you in a certain way, you respond to that treatment of that I've treated you, you respond in that same way. By going back and forth, we then shore up a way of treating one another, so we kind of evolve ourselves into a particular way of doing things, which presumes that we've started out individually and then we started interacting. So
one footnote, which is actually about a footnote, I do recommend looking at the acknowledgments. And the acknowledgement in this piece in particular is like a list of who's who in IR theory. It's really amazing. And across the political and methodological and theoretical spectrum, as it were. Now, I think the point I wanted to pick up on there is that this is obviously, world systems theory is gone now. We're talking about structural realism and we're talking about neoliberalism. So here, if you want to think about it, is a moment where we're starting to congeal the triumvirate of the three paradigms of the paradigm wars. And he's positioning himself in a way where liberals should, he calls constructivism strong liberalism, right? So he's positioning himself as constructivism as being what you would do if you really took liberalism more seriously than some of the liberals do. It's kind of the natural place for people like Bob Cohen, for him, in this article. And then rhetorically, I think the other thing that's important is that, of course, one of Waltz's taglines, right, is that process is different from structure. So here he's taking that tagline and he's turning it on its head. He's saying, you know, it's the process that's really important. It's the process stupid, as it were. So his critique here is rationalism and it's structural realism. And his argument, just in brief, is that there is no natural necessity according to anarchy. This is the constructivist element of it, that anarchy has no objective or as if objective logic, that anarchy is kind of an empty concept, and that the character of relations among actors without a superordinate authority can vary tremendously, anywhere from being very cooperative to being much more conflictual even than structural realists claim. And if you know the social theory of international politics version of this argument, the social theory of international politics version of this argument is to talk about three ideal types, right? The Hobbesian anarchy, which is realism, Lockean anarchy, which is liberalism, and like Locke, says that the state of nature is inconvenient and generally not really preferable by and large to a well-constituted government, but cooperation is possible and some respect for property rights is possible there, to what he calls a Kantian anarchy, which is essentially the full-blown, other-regarding, collective security, security community version of anarchy, where we don't have any kind of dynamics that we would associate with Waltz's understanding of anarchy. So here, very clearly, we've moved into a domain where it is, if it isn't obvious already, where the social constructivist claim is a claim against a certain natural necessity claim associated with realism, and that is that anarchy has natural and inevitable consequences. And Wendt's argument is no, it does not. It depends on the meanings and the build-up history of interactions and the ideas about identity and collective identification that happen through processes of interaction between states in an environment what we might call anarchical, although anarchy there has really no force of anything interesting. And so you're right, there's this big change here. It is in many ways different and frankly more accessible than the 1987 piece. He's also able to draw on a lot more people who are sort of now in, to yoke together a lot more people who are sort of fleshing out the constructivist camp. So like it struck me very early on, he name checks, I think, a really terrific article, which is the Tocqueville and Ruggie piece on international organizations, state of the art or art of the state, which makes some really profound and important arguments about norms, arguments that I think we still would do well to pay attention to in the field. But one person who does not show up here, and I know because I searched for it, is Hedley Bull. There is no English school here, which is really weird at some level, because his understanding of self-help as a social institution of anarchy sounds a heck of a lot like primary institutions or social institutions in English school theory. And of course, this will generate a revival and repurposing of English school theory as a kind of precursor or perhaps for some people's eyes, a better version of constructivism. But I did think that's striking. You know, this is very similar to the English school understanding of, say, the balance of power as a social institution, international politics, that matters insofar as states buy into it as a way of maintaining fundamental aspects of international society like sovereignty. There's a lot of that kind of stuff going on here, but there's not a lot of acknowledgement or engagement with English school theory.
Right. No, and the place I would have expected that engagement is on page 399, where he has this definition of institution as, quote, a relatively stable set or structure, and he even puts the word structure in academic scare quotes, of identities and interests. And then interests for him in this point are defined as identities within identities as appropriate goals. That is virtually identical to the way an institution is defined in Bull's anarchical society. So it is kind of an interesting omission that that's not the direction that he wants to engage here. But what strikes me again about this and that particular formulation is those scare quotes around structure, that there's a way that Wendt seems to be arguing here that the so-called structures of international politics are much more evanescent than we have been led to believe. Even though later on in the article, he'll talk about how they can become robust and how they may not be amenable to easy change and transformation, at least this kind of theoretical perspective would hold open the possibility of transforming those things, which if we think that the structures of international political life are fixed and if not actually natural necessity, then functionally the equivalent of natural necessity, then trying to change them would make absolutely no sense. But here, I think the timing of Wendt's article is also tremendously important, because he is writing this, it's published in 1992, which means it's undoubtedly being written 1990, 1991, going through the peer review process. What else is happening in the world in 1989, 1990, 1991? You have the collapse of the Soviet Union and the end of Cold War bipolarity, which, if you had looked back 5 years previously, virtually nobody was arguing that bipolarity was the sort of thing that could evaporate overnight in the international system, or that the Soviet Union could literally cease to exist pretty much in the space of a couple of weeks. And that's what happened outside of people's windows as they were going through this. And I think that matters quite a bit for the way that Wendt, part of the plausibility of Wendt's argument is because you can look out the window in 1992 and say, oh, these things we used to think of as fixed and firm essential features of international political life turn out to be a lot more fragile than we thought they did. Isn't that interesting?
Yeah, I mean, I think he wanted to make the case that Soviet glasnost gave rise to IR glasnost. You know, I've been waiting to say that.
I know.
This is one of the articles that you would clearly point to, and it is very, I mean, you also have some of Kratochvil's work, et cetera, but it's very obvious here. The whole story about altercasting and trying to redefine the basis of relationships is a story about Gorbachev and new thinking and various kinds of concessions that Gorbachev is making in order to try to convince the United States that we're in a different kind of game, that we have different identities and interests at stake, and that we ought not to be doing the Cold War anymore. So very much, right, this is both motivated empirically, to the extent that it has empirical content, by the end of the Cold War, and it also very clearly is influenced by the end of the Cold War in terms of, as you say, the reduction of the importance of structure as a reference point, and the shift towards a notion of institutions which is loosey-gooseyer, which is more kind of practices and bundles of ideas and things like that. So I think that's very clear. So a couple things off the top I wanted to add. So Wendt makes there's some really smart stuff that happens at the beginning of this article, right? Which is to point out essentially that liberals in the form of neoliberal institutionalism made a decision that they were going to be an internal critique of realism, right? And so that they were going to basically make their claim, they were going to stake their claim to the ability of institutions to transform international politics in ways that made realist and realpolitik dynamics less salient, that they were going to do that by showing that cooperation was possible under anarchy, and that they did so with reference to Coase's theorem and notions of more broadly notions of transaction costs, the quote-unquote solution to the prisoner's dilemma of iterated cooperation, that they pointed all these things to say, hey, look, even under anarchy, you can get stable cooperation. And Wendt does this really interesting thing where he calls that weak liberalism. He says, you know, that's good, it's important, but it doesn't go far enough. And he says, he picks up on very nicely the way where places where Bob Cohen and others kind of make reference to the idea that this iterated cooperation might be shifting norms or might be shifting identities. And he says, you know, the strong version of liberalism would be to say that it really can transform fundamental features of those relationships, and that's where constructivism gets you. So he firmly allies constructivism with liberalism and argues that liberals should go over and be constructivists because we are pushing your arguments to their logical conclusion and we are a stronger critique of realism and the idea of the inevitability of realpolitik. So that's the first thing that I think is really important here as both a political intervention and also as something that actually is going to shape what constructivism looks like for a while, or at least picks up on the way in which constructivism does really become a strong form of liberalism in a lot of variants. Right. And this has implications for how you think about critical theory, how you think about post-structuralism, where Foucault fits in, for example, to the constructivist research program. Because these people don't, even though Alex goes out of his way in this article to try to make space for them, just as he did in the 87 piece, these do not fit comfortably into his story, right, into his vision. The second element is the stress on identity. Right, identity as being the roots of interests. So social roles produce interests, and so interests are always tied to intersubjective understandings that are shared or at least weakly shared by agents. And that identities, in the form of collective identification, what I talked about earlier, is really the variable, as it were, that's driving variation in the character of anarchy. Now, what's really interesting here is that you know, in a sense, if I said about 87, we're all Wentians in terms of his articulation of structuration theory as a research program, in this sense, none of us are Wentians, because the idea, or very few of us, because the identity aspect of constructivism has really dropped out of, I mean, it didn't take long to drop out of constructivism, or at least people who thought of themselves as capital C constructivists. And it's really kind of dropped out pretty heavily of anything that would be recognizably constructivism, right? We moved on to norms as the linchpin for constructivist theory. And there, I think Finnemore is a really important reference point in one who isn't, you know, we're not reading right now, but we should probably read later, right? You know, in a sense, Wendt may have created the space, but maybe the constructivism as it develops lives more in Finnemore's world and Sicking's world and Riis's world than in Wendt's world. Wendt's world.
Party time. Excellent. I think that's exactly right. I think that what's interesting about the way that Wendt formulates identity in here, the sort of strong internalization of circulated narratives, I'll disagree with you just slightly. There are some people, I think, who really tried to push that kind of constructivism for a while. So, but what that turned into is it turned into socialization. And that turning into sort of socialization theory and utilizing these sort of unconsciously Parsonsian formulations about what it takes to become part of a social system so you can reproduce it by internalizing the narratives associated with Jeff Checkle and some of the folks who talk about norm internalization as being the key dynamic there. So identity gets replaced with a different term, but the role that it plays in the theory, I think, is still fairly important. And it's important because for Wendt's formulation, because this is a very culturalist understanding of social relations, intersubjective means shared subjectivity. And so when he says on 417, he's talking about the way that you could strengthen the Robert Axelrod evolution of cooperation argument about how game theoretical prisoner's dilemma iterations could give rise to cooperation. The mechanism that he poses for this is internalize new understandings of self and other. And he says, well, what that does is not just lead people to play that game differently, but perhaps even transforms the game because they understand the structures of it differently. Contrast this to work that someone like Haywood Alker did on what he called the reflective resolution of iterated prisoner's dilemma games, where why having people play prisoner's dilemma games against one another, but have them record their own internal narrative of what they were doing, what you got there is not shared subjectivity. What you got there was a different way of constituting the game from each side and from the perspective of each player. So not so much of a stress on shared notions going across the players, and more on the malleability of structure. So in a way, Alker's work was much more structurationist about this than the formulation that Wendt has, which is very much structure is a derived consequence of individual interactions that ultimately has to be traced back to the mentality of those individuals. And the individuals here can be biological individuals, or they can be states, because he wants to be able to scale this argument back and forth, which is then what's going to set the stage for the 99 book. So you had a point you wanted to make, and then I had another thing I wanted to say, not quite on this point, but go ahead and make
it. I want to amend my statement. There are two directions that this article points in. One is the role norm conception. The other is the identity boundary conception. It's the role norm conception that has been picked up. And so that is in Wendt. I mean, it is very clearly in this article. The second point, which I think you already hinted at, is that, you know, very famously, he grounds his argument in symbolic interactionism, or a couple of symbolic interactionist authors, Mead primarily, in a way that's very actor-centric. And so it's a little bit ironic, given the stance in the other piece, that here we get more of a kind of, what really does feel like a more actor-centric or interactionist or relational account, one that is moved even further away from the idea of structures as things other than a shared set of meanings and values that are constantly kind of reproduced and produced by the actors who operate within them. And I don't think that's... I don't think it's an accident. I don't think it's necessarily bad, but it is an important kind of shift. Finally, which maybe is what you're going to talk about, is that this, the force of this argument is in many ways, part of it's dependent on Gorbachev, and I actually think that part is more persuasive. The other force of the argument is based on this thought experiment about ego and alter sort of encountering each other for the first time. You know, that's the idea, if you were on the desert island, you could wind up in Lord of the Flies, or you could wind up in Gilligan's Island, depending on what the people there were like, right, and how they initially interacted with one another. He sort of uses this as a thought experiment for figuring out what anarchy is, and then he grounds it, he supercharges it. He says, he tries to kind of give it a kind of more reality by talking about aliens.
And that thought experiment is one that I know a number of us, myself included, always use in introductory international relations or world politics courses to be able to introduce some elements of social construction. I actually have a drill that I do with the students where I put a picture up of an alien spacecraft and say, okay, that was spotted in orbit. Break yourselves up into small groups, and the president needs recommendations in 20 minutes, or the UN Security Council needs recommendations in 20 minutes. Go. And then people go and try to figure this out. What quickly emerges in that conversation, almost every year that I've done this, and I've done this for a long time now, but doesn't emerge in Wendt's account at all, is the way that stories that we tell about alien encounter are not created de novo in the interactive moment, but draw on a past cultural context, a history of interactions, a set of imagined interactions, a set of stories. So the debate about what do we do if aliens suddenly show up in Earth orbit becomes a debate about, is this a Star Trek type situation or is this Independence Day? And it's conducted in those kinds of pop cultural science fiction terms. That's not really, that history is not on display in Wendt's thought experiment, because the ego-alter interaction is supposed to be a complete blank slate interaction. So it's as if the parties bring nothing whatsoever into the situation. And there's a problem there in that even an imagined first encounter like that would always have some kind of backdrop on which the actors were drawing. And that doesn't seem to be part of Wendt's story here.
So I actually think, I've told that story too, and I've used your experiment in various, your class pedagogical tool in various sorts of ways. I think it's a little bit unfair to him here, rereading it. I mean, I do think there is a kind of implicit assumption. He talks about mobilizing the armed forces initially. There's a kind of implicit assumption that we would be reading what they're doing filtered through prior knowledge about interaction.
The problem is that if we accept that, if we accept that we're going to be reading through some kind of prior imagined or projective version of what these encounters are like, then the first encounter between ego and alter can't possibly be the first encounter between ego and alter. It always has to have been prefigured.
And then, of course, it turns out that this argument isn't actually quite the thought experiment we think for Alex, because Alex is very committed to the idea that there are unidentified flying objects, and those unidentified flying, well, we all agree they're unidentified flying objects, but that those unidentified flying objects are aliens who are conditioning us for eventual reveal. You know, so in a sense, he thinks they're already here, and so that becomes, that has a different valence in the, than we might have assumed. In the same way that I think the why the world state is inevitable argument has a different valence when you reread the 1994 piece in APSR and realize he's already making the argument that the world state is inevitable, and that in some ways it's already here. And I think it's actually a very smart way that doesn't necessarily get credited. I do want to stress here, there is some, you know, we've sort of been skeptical of elements of the argument, but the discussion of sovereignty recognition is really good. And the basically the idea here that the foundation of Waltzian anarchy is sovereignty. Sovereignty is a form of recognition. It's only through that recognition that you can produce anarchical relations in the first place. And I think it's a really powerful argument. It's really well put here, right? In the terms of recognition, recognition of the other and what is the nature of the other and what is the relationship to the self. And the notion that even there's a kind of common set of roles, that you're agreeing that a set of you have similar rights and perquisites. And so that require, that is always social. It's not sort of mechanistic in the way that I do think it is correct to say that, that Walt certainly winds up coming across as arguing.
And I think that on that same line of thinking about the really insightful little pieces of this argument, there's a suggestion on page 404 where he's talking about the difference between making decisions based on probabilities and decisions made on possibilities, and points out that most decisions are and should be made on the basis of probabilities, and these are produced by interaction, by what actors do, which is an interesting summation of the, not Walt, but classical realist argument that one should always think about the most extreme possibility and defend against it. So there's a suggestion here that maybe the problem is that certain kinds of classical realists are overweighting the probability of extreme possibilities. And I think that's a really interesting intervention into a set of international relations theoretical debates when we start thinking about the differences between offensive and defensive realists and optimistic and pessimistic realists and such, that Wendt is pointing out, no, there's more to it than that. You can't simply go directly from a possibility to an outcome without talking about the likelihood of that outcome actually occurring. I do find it fascinating that the way he makes that point is by adopting kind of Bayesian theoretical language here, which is, of course, a very rationalist mode of analysis that presumes the autonomy of the actor. So once again, we've got this kind of actor centricity that comes in. The other point I wanted to call attention to quickly is something he says it a number of times throughout the piece, but the formulation of it that grabbed me is on page 411. And this is continuing with the theme of the evanescent quality of structure. But there's a moment in that Wendt seems to suggest that after you've interacted and interactively produced a structure enough, that it sort of switches and it becomes something that you can then treat as, what does he say on 411? Once constituted, any social system confronts each of its members as an objective social fact that reinforces certain behaviors and discourages others. It's the once constituted phrase that got me. If we take the structurationist insight from the 87 piece seriously, there's never a moment at which constitution finishes. It's always ongoing co-constitution. But in order for Wendt's argument to be something other than an individualist argument where institutions are just something that gets kind of conveniently whipped up between individuals and can be dissolved at will, there has to be a sort of switch where now that we've been reciprocally typifying and interacting with each other on a particular basis to a certain level, we now somehow pass some threshold of constitution. And now, okay, now it's a thing, and it sort of runs, the social structure now basically runs on its own. It has become, the term Wendt would want to use here is reified. I would want to use the term that Joseph Lapid likes instead, which is the term arrested, that the movement of the interactive possibilities have sort of congealed, so you have this relative stability that now goes on, but that's an empirical phenomenon rather than some sort of deep theoretical phenomenon. The point is, Wendt needs that moment to happen. Otherwise, this entire theory turns into not strong liberalism, but relatively weak liberalism. So the value added is the idea that by interacting, we can sort of lock in a new kind of arrangement. So there has to be that lock-in moment, that the social institution has to develop what he calls later on a self-perpetuating quality to it, so that you can then treat it as if it was sort of going on all by itself. If you don't have that moment, then this collapses back into individualist liberalism.
Right, well, I mean, for him, it has to be institutionalized, right? That's the whole, and this is why social institutions and institutionalist language features so heavily in this piece, much more heavily than in the agent structure problem piece. I do want to say here that this is also, 410 and 411 are actually great pages. Like, I have all sorts of notes about 410 and 411, not only in 410, because that's where he talks about reification again through Berger and Luckmann, but what he means is the assumption of natural necessity to anarchy, the view of anarchy as an objective social fact that cannot be altered, right? And he says this is a mistake. Self-help is an institution, right? A social institution. Right. But then on 411, the section you're talking about, it's also very clear the way in which this is a recapitulation of a series of debates that makes sense if you understand the social theory that everybody's drawing on. If you understand Parsons and Giddens and Archer and all these people who are arguing about a sort of body of kind of parallel arguments in sociology, Because this is where, you know, you're really saying, look, you know, if Walt says there's only one role structure that matters and it's relative great power or lesser power, or more fine-tuned, it's whether you're a great power in a multipolar system or a bipolar system or weak power, right? That's sort of the variation. Here he's now introducing there are all these senses of role variation. The United States is a leader of anti-communist crusades, is a role that can be institutionalized. You know, and Waltz's argument is essentially that's fine, that stuff happens, but it's not really a big change in the level of structure, right? So in a sense, you know, this argument hinges as an argument against structural realism on him being able to make the case that it is. And again, that's why the Cold War and the end of the Cold War is so important as both a kind of empirical case, but also as a bludgeon, right, to hit realism over the head. The second thing is that I actually thought this was really interesting. If you read his discussion of this stuff, though, honestly, if you got rid of some of the median language and the kind of social theory, you could superimpose this onto any given realist argument about why expanding NATO was a mistake. Right? It's identical. It's the same logic. Well, by expanding NATO, we locked in a certain set of relations with Russia where we threatened them and we constituted ourselves as a threat. If we hadn't expanded NATO, that wouldn't have happened. Russia would have, given their sphere of influence, we would have a different set of relations. So what I think is really fascinating here is that despite all of the arguments between realists and constructivists in the way in which these are kind of the most oppositional of camps, supposedly, according to Wendt, ultimately, you know, when the rubber hits the road for realism, it sounds a hell of a lot like constructivism, at least in the way that Wendt describes it.
Yeah. No, I think that's right. And I think that's also one of the things that a number of us who tried to articulate that realist constructivism at different times picked up on. The fact that a lot of the empirical payoff here is not all that different and is equally skeptical of universalist rationalist institutions. So there is an unexplored alliance, which I think, to go back to something you said before about the sociology of this particular piece, the alliance between constructivists and liberals that is forged in this piece sets a lot of the terms of debate that go on for the next 10-15 years, where the understanding is that realists are the common enemy of both constructivists and liberals, because constructivists and liberals believe that anarchy doesn't always mean war. And that obscured the ways that constructivism could also ally with certain kinds of realism in opposing a liberal notion that rationality and science will always trump sets of power considerations. So there is a sociological effect of this piece that I think is related to, but not exactly the same as its intellectual argument.
Nom nom nom. So Maya just brought me some cookies. We took a short break after that. So we were talking about realist constructivism and liberal constructivism, is that it? In the ways that I actually saw some real parallels here between the kinds of arguments that Wendt is making and standard arguments about the United States constituting itself as a threat vis-a-vis Russia or China that you see in defensive realist arguments, right? Or even in some offensive realist arguments like, you know, John Mearsheimer's. And I think that was kind of interesting. Clearly, at some level, there is a distinction in that realists would argue that there are certain kinds of law-like effects of anarchy that condition those responses, while Wendt would not agree. But there is a lot of convergence, I think, in practice. And I think that's more interesting for realist theory than for constructivist theory, to be honest.
Yeah, I think so. I think the exclusive focus, or not exclusive focus, but paramount focus on determinate effects of anarchy that we see in Wendt's 92 piece takes attention away from other ways that constructivist points about the non-inevitable character of various international political institutions actually parallel certain threads in realist thought. I remember being very excited one day when I was in graduate school, looking at Arnold Wolfer's old essays on statecraft as moral choice, and the indeterminacy of the concept of national security or national interest and thinking, oh, but this is a constructivist argument. This is an argument that is really about the non-inevitable character of consequences that are mediated by sets of social practices and varying understandings that different kind of actors bring to bear on situations. And for sociological reasons, Wolfers is a realist, not a constructivist, even though there's an awful lot of parallel in terms of the specific critique that he was making.
This is why people like me and Stacy have decided to start calling ourselves heterodox realists, in the sense that we think we share certain things with realism, that is a focus on power politics, on the kind of inevitability of power politics of one form or another, but without a lot of the additional assumptions that go into the realist mainstream, say, for example, about the overriding importance of kinetic power or military power, primarily and then secondarily economic power. Arguments which, by the way, are relaxed all the time, right, when you get into practical situations. That's a whole nother discussion. I did want to say, before we move on to our final kind of theoretical thoughts about this piece, that one thing that definitely made me go meh was Wendt's discussion, very brief discussion, of Augsburg and Westphalia. And I do want to point out that Wendt, like a lot of constructivists who are interested in ideas and norms at the time, who haven't quite done the historiographical work yet that will come later, with people like Benjamin de Cavelio and Andreas Kern, is still kind of viewing Augsburg and Westphalia as important points in the kind of recognition of sovereignty. When in fact, if you want the best case for this, you can read Dan Philpott's work, but you know where I stand. I don't think this had anything to do with sovereignty. And I think that it's a kind of a little too convenient for constructivists to be able to point at a couple of treaties, you know, moments of decisions where everybody agrees on certain norms as being constitutive of sovereignty, when in fact, in reality, there's nothing related to what we think of as sovereignty going on in these treaties historically.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. I had a similar kind of empirical meh moment, not about Westphalia, but about the way that Wendt understands Ruggie's embedded liberalism, 418, 419 or so, because he reads embedded as if that meant stably established beyond a reasonable doubt, where I think what Ruggie really means is something like centrality. So embedded liberalism means that a certain kinds of principles of global political liberalism are central to the organization of these post-war arrangements, not that these are so taken for granted that there was no contestation about them and that everybody just kind of did them because they had become nigh upon structural inevitabilities. So I don't think that's true in terms of the history. There's an awful lot of debate about what it means to engage in a kind of post-war liberal order. And the fact that Wendt, I understand why, because he's trying to make this point about things becoming stabilized and therefore being gaining this taken for granted or reified quality. But I don't think that's actually Ruggie's argument, and I don't think it really lines up with history either. That's not really what the story is about. The story is about articulating various visions of what it means to be a post-war liberal order, or visions of what it means to have a certain kind of liberal stability, and so on. And in that sense, it's always an ongoing process rather than something that finishes at a certain point, and then you could say, oh, okay, now it's a presupposition we can just kind of take with us. If that were the case, then I'm not sure why Ruggie would have had to write the embedded liberalism article in 1983 to call our attention to it, so...
I thought that was an interesting example because you know that one of my hobby horses has to do with the way in which liberal order has become a hot topic today. So I think there's a tendency to look back on Wendt's work or Dessler's work or any of the really explosion of work on the agent structure problem and how we might best think through the relationship between agents and structures and therefore get a handle on continuity and change in international politics as somewhat kind of passé, boring, the kind of thing that grad students might care a lot about these days, but you lose interest in because you got to just kind of get on with it. And so there's a way in which we said, you know what, that was sort of something that was in the past. Maybe it's associated with the paradigm wars, which we don't like anymore. But in fact, we've just kind of brought in these debates through the back door of liberal order. Right. So there's a lot of discussion, even among realists, right? You can even read IS pieces about liberal international order, particularly with what's wrong with the concept, in which we've just kind of reinvented all this stuff about, well, is liberal order a structure? How constraining is it? How do we know there's a liberal order? What constitutes liberal order? How do we understand transformation in liberal order? And so we're basically arguing about agent structure issues, but nobody will come out and say it. And I think it's really impoverished these debates about international order, particularly because the way we've understood international order is very Wentian, right? It's very Fenimorean, or it's that particular trajectory of constructivism. It's rules, norms, and arrangements. So we all kind of accept that as being liberal order or international order. And then we don't really do any of the hard theoretical work that I think Alex rightly tells us we need to do if we want to talk about these kind of crucial issues.
No, I agree. And I think you even see this in self-identified constructivists. You see this in some of, say, Emmanuel Adler's most recent work, where he wants to talk about ordering, and ordering is an ongoing set of processes. But in order to make the argument work, he still has to at some point posit the idea that that ordering becomes an order, and that then you can sort of make derivations from it as if it were already stable. And there's a tension that kind of runs through a lot of even constructivist thinking about this on precisely that point. And I think a lot of it has to do with this idea that, well, we already kind of fought those debates out. We don't need to go back and do this more fundamental rethinking again, that somehow we can move on from this, which I think, to go back to the 87 piece where we started the conversation, is a fundamental misreading of the problem that Alex reads correctly, which is that the agent structure problem isn't something that you solve. The agent structure problem is a perpetual issue in social theory that there are various resolutions to in different kinds of theoretical vocabularies and conceptual systems. And we have to have some way of evaluating those provisional resolutions or solutions to the agent structure problem, not because one of them is categorically right and the others are wrong, but because how we incorporate these things into a theory matters for how we think about what the theory is actually going to do. Wendt's suggestion that the only way to evaluate that is a scientific realist way by talking about the reality of the agents of the structures and their codetermination, I'm not on board with that being the only way to think about how we evaluate answers to the agent structure problem. But the overall problematique that he poses, the idea that you can't avoid having some kind of answer to the relationship between agents and structures in your social theory at a very fundamental level, I think he's absolutely right about that. And we do ourselves a disservice by imagining that we don't need to actually grapple with these issues.
Although I have to take a second to defend Emmanuel here, right? I mean, yes, it's true that like any approach to these issues, there are going to be transition points that you can't account for. Right? Or they're going to be things you have to make assumptions about because of ways in which our language and our ability to even talk about these things empirically runs into trouble if we really try to get co-constitution right, if we think co-constitution is even the right framework. But for me, Emmanuel's one of the good guys because at least he's talking about order. And he's saying, you know, there are really a bunch of hard theoretical and analytical problems when we talk about order. And to me, what's happening is that we are replicating these debates without talking about it, right? I think I sent out a tweet that said, we thought we were done with the agent structure problem, but we let it in through the back door of international order, and now it is hanging out in our living room, eating our snacks and drinking our beer, and we're pretending it's not there. You know, people like Emmanuel, some of the English school theorists, they're not pretending it's not there. But they're not in actually very close dialogue with the people who are having the big arguments now about the fate of international order and what's happening to it, given certain kinds of developments like U.S. relative decline, like the relative rise of China, like Trumpism, et cetera, et cetera. So the people who are engaged in those debates are doing it in a very kind of atheoretical way, where they're making a whole set of assumptions about how do you transform order? What is order? That even when they're more theorized are still kind of, we don't talk about the fact that these are agent structure problems, and that makes me nuts. And indeed, if there's this, as you know, in Exit from Hegemony, there's a more kind of simplified story in the narrative, right, in the main text. But if you read the endnotes, there's like a parallel theoretical argument going on. And this is one of the things that I spend a good like 3 pages of a single footnote talking about. So that's...
Mm-hmm. I know that footnote.
Oh, well, thank you. Have you had the chance to read it yet?
I have not finished the entire book. I have dipped into it a little bit, but I found that footnote, and I was very happy about that. Like, oh, here we go. Here's the thick stuff, right? This is what's not there in this debate. I completely agree with you, and I agree for all of the issues that I have sometimes with the way that Immanuel wants to cash this out for in terms of the notion of cognitive evolution. I think he's certainly going in a direction that takes these issues much more seriously than a lot of other people.
Well, I think the point is that we disagree with certain kinds of assumptions he brings in, but we don't, because we're not scientific realists, we can say, okay, right, that's fine. We can take a more Peter Katzenstein analytical eclecticism route and say what you said, which is that these are problems which just cannot be resolved, right? And they cannot be definitive. We cannot solve them. We just can grapple with them in different ways, and we can clarify some of the things that are at stake,
right,
or maybe make some improvements in particular kind of explanatory theory if we try to figure out how our social ontology aligns with the kind of phenomena we want to understand.
Right, as long as we're not falling into the kind of neopositivist absurdities that you run into sometimes, where we imagine that agents and structures are rival hypotheses that we could empirically test against each other.
Right. I think that the other thing I would say here is that it's funny because we have focused on the disjuncture in some ways between 87 and 92. I think that, you know, if you looked at our work in 99 and contrasted it with our work a few years later, you would see similar disjunctures. So, you know, in a sense, that's not that big a deal. It's mostly important for understanding some things about intellectual history. And it's important for understanding that if you read 87, you're not getting the same story entirely as you're reading 92, and that these are not precisely the same arguments. But ironically, like from our perspective, this move towards more process-oriented arguments is probably an improvement, right? I mean, this is where we think we ought to be. No?
No, I think that the process language, and certainly moving towards thinking of structure as structuring process, is an improvement. The issue that I have with the way that Rent cashes this out in 92 is the kind of rump individualism of the whole thing. So to put it in language that, you know, we like from Dewey and Bentley, it's an interactionist account rather than a transactional account. And this is related to the way that intersubjectivity in the 92 piece is very much about patterns of subjective assent. And I think that wasn't necessarily the implication of the 87 piece. It's, you can see traces of it there, but certainly by 92, this is kind of the direction that Wendt is going. But I think that if we were to treat these kinds of structuring processes as less being about subjective mentalities and more being about practices and ordering practices and you know, organizational practices, structuring practices, or what Nick Onuf would call arrangements, then I think we would have an ontology for this that would be much more of a practice-centered ontology that I think is what you and I are a little more comfortable with when it comes to these things. And I think next, the thing we're going to be reading is actually going to be looking at this as well, right? We're going to read the Yaching Chin piece?
I think we should finish out our discussion of these two pieces by returning to a theme that we have been talking about a little bit, and then sort of, it's come out in kind of dribs and drabs, which is the relationship between this argument and so-called heterodox constructivisms. People wouldn't call themselves constructivists, but we would see as constructionists, right, in that hacking sense.
Mm-hmm.
You know, post-structuralists, critical theorists of various stripes, feminist theorists, certain kinds of Marxists, so on and so forth. I've actually probably said some things that are repetitive there, right? Kronos critical theorists are somewhat Marxist, usually, maybe? No? Yes? Who knows? Anyway, the main point of this is that there is an interesting and somewhat paradoxical dynamic here, because if you read both these pieces, you can really see that Alex is trying to rope these theories into the conversation. right? He's trying to build space for them. He's trying to say that they're legitimately part of the mainstream discussion. He's doing that through references and through footnotes and by invoking certain concepts from them and saying, hey, look, these people are talking about the same things that you're talking about, even if their language is a little different. So on the one hand, you've got this inclusive Alex, right? On the other hand, you have this sense, which I think is not entirely unjustified among a lot of people doing this work, that Alex is stripping out important parts of their theory, or he's domesticating what they're doing for mainstream liberal consumption, or he's reducing what they're doing in ways that they would not agree with and that they find deeply problematic. And this paradox has run through all of Alex's work, right? This really need to kind of bring everybody together, but in the process of doing it, representing work in ways that really upset the people who he's trying to bring to the table.
Yes, I think that's a fair characterization. There is a generosity that Alex has and always has had in his work of acknowledging the disparate sources on which he draws, the disparate traditions. And he'd be the first to say he's not the first person to have thought of these things. And he's pulling these things from other kinds of places. But at the same time, like the way in the 92 piece, the way he, parenthetically, something that I found I sort of remembered but didn't really remember was that he doesn't talk about himself as a constructivist in the 87 piece. It's not until the 92, which is an interesting sort of sociological commentary on the field. But the way that he incorporates Onuf and Onuf's understanding of constructivism, he acknowledges that Onuf is the person who coined the term constructivism in IR and is the first person to have started using it. True, but that's it. He doesn't engage them with Onuf's argument, which goes in a very, very different kind of direction. So on the one hand, that's great because it opens it up and says, if you're going to take this stuff seriously, Onuf is someone you should have to read. You should have to take a look at this. But sociologically, what a lot of people did is they didn't use that as a reason to go off and read Onuf. So I think some of the fear of some of the different other sources that Alex is citing here is precisely that the people will think, oh, okay, well, I don't have to read them, Went read them, and I can just kind of cite him on this. The other thing I think that is, I get it, but it even still today kind of sticks in my gut a little bit. The ending of the piece, right? The way that at the end of the piece, he turns this back into a, you know, we shouldn't really be so worried about these sorts of, that we shouldn't be worried about the idea of like disciplining science, right? So that this is not it. Instead, we should be strong liberals and constructivists have much to learn from each other if they can see through the smoke and heat of epistemology. I get what he's saying, but on the other hand, there's a kind of dismissal of those epistemological issues in that formulation. And earlier on in the piece, when he has that whole thing about science celebrating its liberation from dissent, you know, there's a way that if you are one of those celebrating your liberation from science, then in the name of dissent, then that's a very not quite, well, maybe it is an offensive formulation. And so there is, it's again, these are the tensions in that exact doubleness that you were talking
about. Even calling people who are doing various forms of critical theory strong liberals, that's a hell of a move. And I imagine that at the time, it's very reminiscent of Bob Cohen's attempt in his reflectivist and rationalist piece to tell essentially where he, I think well-meaningly, but disastrously tells feminists, you know, you could just, why aren't you just liberals, right? And so, you know, there is all of those kinds of overtones in this piece. And I think it's unfortunate because I don't think that's the way Alex thinks about the world. And I don't think that's what he's trying to do. He's trying to build bridges, but building bridges can mean that you are narrowing the roads, right? It can mean that you are you're pushing some people over the edge, or you're forcing them to conform to certain kinds of debates that they don't want to conform to. And that definitely is at play in this piece, I think more than in the 87 piece.
And I think also this sort of loops back to one of the places that we started today, the way that Alex is always translating sociological, social theoretical, philosophical concepts from outside of the field. But in order to do that, one has to engage with the way those lines have already been drawn within the field. And the optimistic reading of that is it's an internal critique of the way the field is organized. And if you didn't organize yourself that way, then you wouldn't actually be able to understand, you wouldn't be able to make yourself understood to people in the field. The pessimistic reading of that is this is the same thing we've heard before. This is just another version of exactly the same thing, because you're adopting those conventional terms once again. I don't know that this is a soluble problem, but it's certainly an issue when one tries to think about these translation exercises. How far is too far?
Yeah, I mean, certainly nobody translates better than Alex.
This is true. This is true. For all of the issues I have. Mm-hmm.
But when you translate, the late Kuhn tells us, when you translate across subdisciplines, you lose some meaning, and that it's what you actually need is bilingualism. And I think that's actually the point you're making, right, is that if you have somebody who's translating, you feel like you don't have to be bilingual or multilingual. And so this is this kind of perverse or paradoxical effect, which is that Alex wants you to go out and read these people who are really influential for him and he thinks are really important, but he almost becomes an excuse for some people not to read them. And we get the translated version of their work in a way that then maybe isn't the best outcome. Last thing, because we have been talking for a really long time, given that we're not even talking about a book, we're talking about 60 pages worth of stuff. I thought that, so this point about translating and about people who Alex wants to bring in the conversation who are not brought into the conversation, this goes back to this thing we've been pointing out, which is that if you think about the roads not taken that we talked about, like a really robust identity constructivism, that is not what happens in critical theory, right? That's not what happens in various people who don't want to call themselves constructivists who are doing social constructionist arguments, right? There you get a lot of work on identity. You get a lot of work on these things that have dropped out of the mainstream, or at least are less common in the mainstream, like Yelena Sobotych, right, whose last name I can never... Yelena, I'm sorry, I can never say your last name correctly. All the way through, you know, Cindy Weber's work, right? These are all very interested in identity in a lot of different facets. And it is interesting, I think, that that's not what's going on in mainstream what wound up going on in mainstream constructivism, to the extent there's a mainstream constructivism left. The same way that you can see the seeds of relational and practice turn work of David McCourt's argument, you can see it all here, and then you can see the ways in which maybe it drops out of the increasing convergence around norms arguments. That is what the mainstream takes to be constructivism and what gets published often as mainstream constructivism. So there's like, it's like you can kind of look back here and you can read a bunch of directions that weren't taken and directions that were taken, or directions that we didn't follow but then have come back. And that's kind of neat, I think, rereading these pieces, whatever mm-hmm. we have to say, negative or positive about it.
No, definitely. And I think it's a combination of roads not taken, but also antecedents that we might not have quite been aware of at the time. So, I mean, we flip back to the 87 piece for a second. Remember that even in the 87 piece, Wendt is arguing we need to have different ways of thinking about types of structure that are relevant for explaining state action. What does he have? Domestic international, domestic political, international economic, international political. So they're all like, the international domestic thing is already built into the structure of the theory. So the one thread that you could follow out of the 87 piece is precisely what happens in mainstream constructivism. So watching that be sort of one possibility among others, it's like it's not wrong to ground that in the work Wendt was doing in the late 80s, early 90s. It's not the only thing you could ground in that work from the late 80s, early 90s. But it is interesting that that is the direction that the mainstream went, arguably because it required the fewest changes of substantive ontological assumptions about what the international system was made of. And the 92 piece in some ways reflects that, because you could argue the 92 piece is Wendt saying, okay, I'm going to take the existing sort of operative ontology of a lot of these theories, which is a state-centric ontology, and I'm just going to run with it. And I'm going to show you what we can do, even starting in that place where you wanted to start. In that way, it replicates the move from liberalism to neoliberalism, saying we're going to basically do this as an internal critique of what already exists. There are strengths and weaknesses to that. There are benefits to that in terms of what it gets us, and there are costs in terms of other kinds of growth.
I mean, one last thing I think about from my perspective, my coda, is that I said very early on that there are very few, Wendtians. There are very few Wendtians in the sense of people who are doing the identity project that Alex lays out in Social Theory of International Politics, and to some degree in 92, right? One of the reasons, I think, is because that was mostly a critical insight, right? That is, that the argument there is, there are elements of the argument about socialization, et cetera, that get picked up on. There are other threads there that he himself is drawing on, learning theory, role theory, that already pre-exist him. But part of that is just that the anarchy is what states make of it argument, as you say, it's a kind of thought experiment. It does what it's intended to do, which is to, if you buy it, show that there's a room for a lot of other kinds of relatively stable arrangements in an system we would call anarchical. So there's aren't a lot of places you can go with that. I mean, once you have that insight, that's going to guide work, but it's not necessarily going to be a research program. So one reason is that, right, it has to do with the character of the theory itself, right, and the kinds of interventions he's doing. And to the extent that you can say there's a research program, it is this 87 structurationist stuff, right? The second reason, I think, though, and this is really important, is that Alex made very little attempt, consciously, I think, to reproduce himself. He did not, by and large, I don't know about all of his students, but certainly with the people who are outside of his program who he mentored, and I certainly with the students I know who he had at Chicago or at OSU, he didn't make any attempt, or at Yale, right, think about Janus, he made no attempt to make these people, to make these students do his thing. Mm-hmm. And so what he was, when it came to kind of what his intellectual project was, it was much more ecumenical, it was much more about developing a space for arguments he found interesting that were roughly in line with a very general constructivist or constructionist viewpoint. And that means you're not going to get people who are, you're not going to get a kind of reproduction of the research program like you get from some other people who have a comparable stature in the field, because that just wasn't the way that Alex has worked, and I assume it's not the way he's working now. And I think that's worth noting, mm-hmm. right? That, there, again, there's a kind of, there's a social dimension, there's an intellectual dimension, but then there's also a kind of agent-centric, if you will, dimension to that.
Right. I mean, I would be remiss if I didn't end that with the observation, the field is what scholars make of it.
Ta-da!
Because I have to, because given the where Wendt went, but no, you're absolutely right. There's a way that Wendt's practice as an intellectual, as someone who could have become the sort of guru and spent 30 years defending something he wrote in 1999, he hasn't done that, right? He's gone off in all sorts of other directions. So
I think this recording proves that the two of us really like listening to each other talk, listening to ourselves talk, and having an excuse to just discuss theory, because we have gone on for an awfully long time again. And I hope that even after I edit this down, it's still going to be really long. So I hope that our listeners get something out of it. And I hope the people who think that we made errors, either of interpretation or of the historiography of the field, do reach out to us and let us know. Because I think that would be pretty interesting, right, to be corrected, to have some of those empirical questions filled in. Mm-hmm. We are going to be back again, probably in another month, but with the quarantine on, it might be sooner. And it's been fun.
It always is. So.
All right.
All right. And I hope the listeners have enjoyed it as much as we have.